Okay. So, do we have any questions from anything we've done before? Okay.
Talking about willpower last time?
Right.
Well, physically, lots of things are very challenging for me.
Right.
And I came to accept, well, that's just the way it is. Mm-hmm. But then I realized, I'm developing willpower by having to do that. So mm-hmm. that's a real positive thing. That was quite a revelation.
Oh, good girl. Glad you realized that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've persevered quite determinedly against shortcomings.
I try. Yeah.
For the sake of the two gentlemen who are here for the first time tonight, this is an ongoing class. It's been going on for a number of months. It's based on Swami Kriyananda's, a training course that Swami Kriyananda wrote when he was in charge of the monks at Mount Washington in the 1950s, and just training disciples for a lifelong dedication to God. So we're sort of ambling our way through his course outline, and we've been talking about what's called necessities on the spiritual path, and we talked about devotion, we talked about willpower. Tonight we're going to talk about discrimination. And so every lesson stands alone. If you find that you enjoy this, the classes are all posted on the internet. You can download them for free. So if you like any piece of this, you can start at the beginning. Okay. So any other comments or thoughts? When my mother developed Parkinson's, which she had for the last 15 years of her life, and it wasn't pretty. Parkinson's is not at all a pleasant experience. But about 10 years into it, she said to me sort of ruefully, I hate to say this, but this disease has been the making of me. Meaning that it just, it focused her energy and forced her to into being all kinds of things that she just never was before, all kinds of good things. And willpower, my gosh, she was just overwhelming by the end with her willpower, which she did not have when it started. You know, so your body comes and goes, and not everything is pleasant. But if at the end of a certain cycle of time, you end up with characteristics of consciousness that will serve you for the rest of your incarnations, you have to ask what's good and bad karma. It's a very, you have to exercise your discrimination, which brings us right to where we are today. So, are there any other thoughts or comments before we go on? Discrimination after devotion, after willpower. And you recall, the first time I taught this, there was a typo, and I called it determination, which I managed to make pretty impressive. But the actual word is discrimination. I'm always looking for this list, which I want to find again. Yeah, number three is discrimination. Discrimination is an extremely important word on the spiritual path. And it is, the way we use it, is the way the word is defined, but it has a special meaning, spiritually speaking, or it has a special application. Because the whole process of the spiritual path is a matter of being able to discern on a very subtle level between competing realities. We have the competing reality of our ego versus our superconscious mind. We have the competing reality of our senses versus our intuition. We have the competing realities of what society tells you is required and what you need to do versus what the masters tell us that we need to do. I was amused just a couple of days ago. I was having a discussion with David Gamow, who's very who's been interested in the stock market since he was 10 years old and worked as a stockbroker, has a tremendous interest in the economy. And we were discussing it from his perspective and also from the perspective of what Swami Kriyananda and Yogananda have said about the next few years bringing some very hard economic times to America and to the world. And I, after it was all over the next day, I had the oddest thought that I wanted to have a lot of gold bars in my closet. I mean, I've never had the slightest interest in money per se. I mean, as my mother said to me, oh, being rich is nice, she said to me once, you'll see, it's nice, you know. I mean, it's fine. I don't mind being able to do what I need to do without having to count every penny. I mean, that's pleasant to me. That's rich. That's as rich as I need to be. So it's never like I've had a thing about money. I've shared with some of you many, many years ago, like in the mid-60s, my friend and I bought a car. And we paid cash for the car because we were living at that time on a completely cash economy. We were dropped out from the whole system. We didn't want any records of our lives anywhere. That it was that period. It was the 60s. You get that right there. So we bought this car with cash. And I'd never bought a car ever in my life. I was, you know, 19 years old. And this car salesman, I mean, I was very inexperienced generally, but this car salesman was one of the most dead human beings I'd ever met that was still vertical. I mean, he just had nothing going on. And he just sold us this car. He had those kinds of sunglasses on in which you see yourself. I mean, I don't know what kind of sales training he had, but the whole time you're talking to him, you're just watching yourself talk to him. It was not at all magnetic. I think he had some kind of a cigar or something in his mouth, but maybe he didn't. Just totally not connecting at all with us. He was just selling us a car. And then when we paid cash and actually literally pulled out the money, his entire demeanor changed. It was like a little child being offered cookies. He took off his sunglasses. He began to interact with us. You know, just the sight of the money actually had such an effect on his consciousness. I've never forgotten it because I've never seen anything like it. It had never crossed my mind to become excited in the presence of dollar bills. But you can see all that it represented. Well, not being anything like that. I had this desire to be able to open my closet and see lots of gold in my closet. You know? Because somehow I thought that would make me safe. You know, then I would be safe. Then all of Ananda would be safe if I just had all this gold in my closet. And you can just see how the mind can sort of lead you down a route like that. Every so often, God just pops a little samskar, you know, a little tiny bit of karma up and lets it float around in your consciousness. And you think, where did that come from? But I was in it. And I could see how, if I didn't have as much discrimination as I have, if a person was not trained to discern among the many different impulses that they have, I mean, that's what people want. They look at this world and they want to find a way to be safe. You know, they need to be able to, you know, get the right job. They need to go to the right school. They need to get the right degree. Then, you know, all of these different things have to happen. And, you know, parents who may have had to struggle what they feel too much in their lives become extremely intent to make sure that their children follow all the right paths and just do everything they're supposed to do out of well-intentioned. But it's all this thought that if we could just get the right system, then we'll be okay. Which is true. If we can just get the right system, we'll be okay. It's just a question of learning to discern among these many competing realities which one is the one that is actually going to take you to the place where you really want to go. And when we talk in spiritual terms about discrimination, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about looking at ourselves. We're talking about looking at other people. We're looking at events, looking at circumstances, looking at choices. Everything that happens is a constant process of trying to discern what the higher truth, what the lesson, what the deeper reality is, what the dharma, which is to say that action which will take us toward higher consciousness, might be. And so one of the things that we need to develop on the spiritual path is we need to be very, very wide awake. One of the things that I enjoyed from the very beginning of knowing Swami Kriyananda was simply that he vibrates and functions on such a high level of energy that just to be with him and to interact without making a complete fool of yourself requires that you just be wide awake. You can't just zone out. You can't just sort of be half present. Now, that experience of having that forced upon you in any circumstance, whether it's in your classes, when you're at school, when you have a demanding job, whether you have a spouse or someone in your family that's very difficult to get along with, anything that keeps you from being able just to zone out and coast is in itself your friend, because the spiritual path, as we've often talked about it, is not a sort of a big event in the sense that it's not created by the dramatic moments. our spiritual progress is what I mean by that. It's actually we build our consciousness. The consciousness we have has been built moment to moment. And the consciousness we will have tomorrow is going to be built moment by moment. And if you also think of it in terms of awakening to the divine spirit, coming into a state of higher awareness, when you do that, it doesn't leave you. It's not like you just wake up for a few minutes and then you go back to being dull like this. I recall once many years ago when I had to work all night when living at Ananda, we had some project, some deadline, and you know, it happens in our lives that we have to work all night periodically just because something has to be done and there's no time at all left to do it. When I was working on the school play, the costumes for the school play, which is something that I do periodically, the year that we did the play on Krishna, it was actually about Mirabai, one of Krishna's devotees. We had these three big statues of Krishna. One of them was 8 feet. It wasn't a statue. It was like somebody had projected onto a board and then, you know, printed it and cut it out. It was really beautiful, but it was 8 feet tall. And there was just so much. Those costumes got so complicated and just got to be such a mess toward the end that the day before the first performance, actually, the first performance was on a Wednesday. I had to teach a Tuesday night class. So I had to teach a Tuesday night class. And then after the whole class was over, I had just all this sewing to do. I had the costumes laid out and all those chairs there, and I just had to go one after the other and sew them. And I just knew I was going to be at it all night. There just wasn't any question about it. But my, I just blotted out the clock. I took off my watch, and I just sat in this temple all by myself all night with Krishna. It was actually one of the most blissful nights I've ever had in my life. Just quietly, and I left here at like 8 in the morning, went home in time to change clothes and come back at 10. And lasted pretty much until 3 in the afternoon when this woman was trying to have a serious conversation with me and I'm looking at her like this. And I finally said, you know, I really want to hear you, but I'm literally falling asleep. I mean, I'm just going away while you're talking. We can't do this. That wasn't even the story I was going to tell. I was just thinking of it because I'm starting on the school play costumes again. But once at Ananda Village, I had to do that same thing. And what was so interesting to me then was the next evening, I wasn't actually even tired. It didn't happen to me like it did with the school play. I wasn't tired. I was full of energy. But I was tired of being awake. You know, I was just tired of being conscious. I just wanted to be unconscious. Just like, because if I stayed awake, I was just going to have to keep doing stuff or meditating or doing something. And I just wanted a break. And it occurred to me how much of sleep is just that, is we grow weary of being ourselves and we just want to forget for a while that we're ourselves. Now, what we have to understand on the spiritual path is that we have to get over that. Master said when he would sleep, he would go into super consciousness. And he said to his devotees once, last night I experimented with sleeping as other people do by going into subconsciousness. It was terrible, he said. Thick walls of flesh hemming me in on all sides. That's how he described it. You know, we think, oh, thick walls of flesh hemming me in on all sides, you know. Let me have it. Because we have an attraction for low energy. That's the vrittis in our spine tell us that it's nice to put out energy sometimes, but then we want to go back down again. So the process of discrimination requires that we at all times be, you know, awake and ready. When Yogananda would come out to give his lectures, what's the first thing he said? How feels everyone? And then he would have them say, awake and ready. And as Swamiji describes it, he would lead them in that, you know, just with this total enthusiasm, just completely taking over the whole auditorium, no matter how big it was, just enveloping everyone with that magnitude of his energy. And then as Swamiji described it, only then was he willing to speak into the room. You know, he wasn't going to just throw his cosmic energy out to people who were only half there listening. He wanted them completely engaged, awake and ready. There's a marvelous story told about him once too, that he was giving a lecture and two people who were right in the front stood up and started to walk out because it wasn't what they wanted. He stopped what he was doing. He said, sit down, go back to your seats. sit down, you will never hear another lecture like this. he made them stay. Amazing charisma. I had an interesting just thought form. This is unrelated, but it was, well, it's all part of discrimination. I was in the post office and I saw someone from the Sangha here, someone that I know. And she didn't see me at first. There was like about 15 people all lined up in that post office, because there's always 15 people lined up in that post office. And out of all of them, I knew her. I knew her name. I knew her life circumstances because she's a friend. She was there. But then I was looking at all the other people and I actually asked myself, what is really the difference between her and these others? And I remembered how Swamiji has commented that wherever he is, everyone looks to him like an old friend. That's how he puts it. He's always behaved as if everyone was a friend. He just treats everyone as if he already knows them. But he's commented on a number of occasions that he'll be in even a large group and he'll just feel like he already knows everyone in the room. And standing in the post office, I was really asking myself, what is the real difference between this woman whose name I know and these people whose names I don't know? You know, it's just such a tiny difference. Even though in our own minds it seems massive, but it's really a very tiny difference. I could just as easily know every single person in this room. I just don't happen to. But one could. And also just that feeling of just sort of expanding your heart out and relating to them as if they were all already your intimate friends. You see, that's how the masters are with us. You remember how when, of course, this was a special relationship when Yogananda met Sri Yukteswar, describing it in Autobiography of a Yogi, and how the first meeting in Varanasi, and then the second meeting when Yogananda came to him 28 days later, 4 weeks later, in his ashram in Puri. And Sri Yukteswar just starts talking about all the details of Yogananda's life. Yogananda had never told him any of that. Inasmuch as you are unhappily situated, he said to him. There'd never been any discussion about whether or not Yogananda was unhappily situated. But Sri Yukteswar just knew it, because it was his consciousness and it was a resumed relationship. They were meeting again after a long separation, but nonetheless they were unified like that. Now, I'm using those examples because we really have to understand what it is we're trying to accomplish. Because many people come into a spiritual life. I mean, we're not all of us. We haven't all, like the people for whom this course was originally written, who have left their homes and are now living in a formal monastery, which is a real line in the sand. But nonetheless, the spiritual commitment that we're all making, even if we still look like people who haven't made such a commitment, that commitment for us, at least potentially, is total and is no less radical than if we had walked into a monastery and the door had slammed behind us, because merely doing that is no guarantee of anything except a change of lifestyle, but not necessarily a change of consciousness. So the change of consciousness that we're seeking is really a question of whether or not we want to have it. Now, what I was starting to say is that we have to really and profoundly appreciate the level of energetic awareness that's being asked of us. That's why I was using Sri Yukteswar as an example, or Swamiji's way of relating to people as an example. And the quality that we're always using is the quality of discrimination, of always asking in every situation, what is the right response here? What is really going on in this situation? How can I further my own spiritual development? How can I serve God in this moment? And sometimes we, life as a people, much in a spiritual form, that because the spiritual path brings you to a state of bliss, and because the path of self-realization is about an ever-expanding sense of joy, that people sometimes imagine that that joy is either sensual or low energy. You know, like being stoned, like being a little bit, drunk. But drunk in such a way that the energy goes down. There was a movie about St. Francis of Assisi that came out many years ago, Brother, Son, Sister, Moon. It was decades ago now. I don't know if it's even still around. And Swami, some people really liked it. Swami absolutely despised it. And he was outraged by it, really. It was beautifully photographed, and for one who didn't really know, it seemed sort of fun. But they portrayed St. Francis as just kind of like always being a little bit inebriated. Just kind of staggering around, enjoying nature, and being a little surprised by all the things that happened around him, you know. Like a stoned person is. Oh, wow, look at that, you know, kind of energy. Just like had nothing to do with the kind of absolutely clear and totally present consciousness and absolute awareness that is really the spiritual path. So we mustn't be afraid on the spiritual path to apply ourselves. And we mustn't be afraid to have everybody else consider us to be over intense, you know, over serious about things. The children of one of my friends, who's the parents are on the path, but the children aren't, but nonetheless, the children, to the parents' gratification, have absorbed more than they let on. Because my friend heard the child who's now a grown-up talking to one of her friends, whose parents are also on the spiritual path, but she is also not. And the one girl was saying to the other, oh yeah, our friends can just do whatever they want, but we always have to think about the deeper meaning of everything we do. It's just like, we just can't escape the way we were raised. But yeah, that's the truth. Whether you're, and even more so, if you're really trying to live for God, you can't just cruise. You have to use your discrimination in every situation to try to understand what's really being asked of you. Now, don't think that discrimination is applied intellectually only. This isn't a question of just like every time a question comes up, you have to write down the pros and the cons and try to figure out, you know, what's happening here. That's why devotion comes first. Because once we're firmly established, and once we have used our willpower, as we talked about, to establish ourselves in a heart-oriented, or at least having the heart part of the story, then what we really end up discriminating on and with is it's a kind of intuitive sense of where the energy is trying to go and how you can cooperate with that energy. And so that part of what I was wanting to say about the word discrimination, it's not an intellectual exercise, although having a keen intellect is often a great help. Because on the spiritual path, we also have to be able to think clearly. And that was part of what I was saying before about don't imagine that this is just a float down the river. You know, we have to be able to think very clearly. We have to because what keeps us from thinking clearly is all the likes and dislikes of the heart, all the prejudices of the heart. When I first met Swami Kriyananda, I was magnetized to him by his vibration before I heard him speak. And I do not remember anything of what he said in that first talk at all, except that I remember thinking to myself afterwards that he was the most intelligent man I had ever met, which for me was really lovely, because I like intelligence. You know, everybody has prejudices. One of my prejudices is in favor of intelligence. I just like that kind of energy a lot. You know, some people are indifferent to it. It's just a quality. Some people are just not as fascinated by the mind as I am. And they aren't wordsmiths, you know, and things like that. Swamiji is all those things, so it's been great for me. But as I got to know him and have gotten to know him over these years, he's been unfailingly the most intelligent person I've ever met, just beyond imagination of expectancy, to use Master's phrase in that sense. Just in any situation, on any subject, he just has such remarkable insights, and he can put facts together, has been able to put facts together and put ideas together. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times over the course of Ananda we've been faced with a problem that just seems insoluble. And many of the people in Ananda are impressive. You know, they're impressively capable very impressive and very bright. But I can't tell you how many times we brought situations to Swamiji that we just could not figure out. And he would just like that. I mean, not even with any effort, he would just be able to discern in the situation where it was trying to go and discern realities that no one else could see, or just think of solutions that once presented were obvious, bringing in people from here or there or whatever it might be. But just, and it just was amazing to me. And I actually really meditated a long time because I like intelligence and I like being intelligent myself and I want more of it. I ask myself, where does that come from? Because he doesn't have the qualities of an intellectual. He doesn't quote lots of books and things like that. And he didn't even finish college. And he has no advanced degrees. He has no degrees at all. But I realized that the secret of his intelligence is the quality of his heart. And I don't just mean that in the fact that he's a loving person or embraces other people's realities, which is what I was talking about before, although that's all part of it. You see, your mind, our minds are prejudiced by the feeling side of us. And if one thinks that isn't true, you just have to watch it really carefully. You have to use your discrimination for a while and you see that's true. I mean, how many of us have gotten involved in something that was really stupid just because we wanted it to be okay? How many people, I mean, I'm old enough to know, how many people marry alcoholics and don't know they're alcoholics? You know, they just don't know. Although, when they finally figure it out, it was like, how could I not have known? Well, I didn't want to know. It's as simple as that. You just don't want to know. If you don't want to know something, you won't know something. If you want a reality to be true, everything in you will support it. I mean, think of how people are when they're depressed. If somebody's feelings are sad, if their feelings are a little hopeless, every single thing that their mind tells them supports that. And if they can switch that fundamental orientation, then everything their mind tells them will support a completely different point of view. So it's the mind does not stand alone. They work together. And what Swamiji has done with his life and had did it from a very young age was that he was absolutely determined simply to understand what is true, what is happening, what is reality, not merely to live by, I want it this way, I want it that way, I'm afraid it won't be this way, I'm afraid it has to be that way. This came out of an experience I had where I was having so much trouble sort of understanding God's will. And when I finally, about a very specific situation, I came to Swami, I said, it's so hard to know what God wants. And I was very emotional about it. He said, no, it's not, just like that. And I was bewildered because he wouldn't give me any other conversation. And usually he's quite forthcoming, not at all. And I had to really take that into meditation. And the meditation was, it's very hard for me to know. But Swami didn't say it was easy for him to know. He just said it was easy to know. And the more I reflected on that, I used my discrimination. And I had to discern within myself that I really just didn't want to know because I was very nervous that God was going to ask something of me that I had no interest in giving. And, of course, then, what I got to do was, you see how the mind and the heart work together? I got to make a big deal about wanting to know God's will, but I never actually had to know it. I got to just, instead, spend all this time being so dramatically engaged in my intense desire to know what God wanted, but constantly keeping any understanding blocked by the fact that only certain options were possible. And since none of those options were Dharma for me at that time, then I could just be confused. And the end of that story was that I realized that I was afraid. And I was able to discern by asking yourself serious questions. You know, what I was afraid of. And I also understood at that point that whenever I was confused about God's will, it was always because I was afraid of something. And I went and spoke to Swami about that afterwards. And if I'm not afraid and willing, really willing to do whatever God wants, it's easy to know, isn't it? Oh, yes, of course, he said. And in my own life since then, and you see, this is how you use your discrimination. When you find yourself, when I find myself in a state of what does God want, what does God want, I stop asking God what he wants, and I ask myself, what am I afraid of? Because it's easy to know God's will if you really want to know. So I ask myself, what am I afraid of? And that doesn't mean, you know, to merely be able to mentally know something is quite different than knowing it. But at least I can start down the right road and I can say, well, you know, this is a big fear for me, whatever X, Y, and Z might be. That doesn't mean I can overcome it just by saying that, but I'm working at the right end of the puzzle. The right end of the puzzle is, okay, Lord, how do I deal with this fear? You know, and the prayer becomes a prayer that God can sort of rub his hands and say, okay, let's get to work. And so that whole process, you see, of just constantly looking at the energy and asking yourself, what is this energy really doing? And being just moving through life with a sort of sensitive interest at all times. We have an expression at Ananda, what's trying to happen here? You know, where is the energy going? Just always sort of staying awake to what's really trying to happen here. Where is this energy going? Sometimes people get a little frustrated with us because we don't always push as much as we might push because we're waiting to see sort of which way the energy is going before we'll figure out how to get on to the story. Okay, any other questions or thoughts here before I go forward? Okay, there's one more point about this which is very important. To be discerning is not to be judgmental. And it's a very important distinction that we have to understand because sometimes people are afraid to be discerning because they think it means to be judgmental. Swami Kriyananda has always been very forthright in his opinions, and it used to really disturb me. When I was much more judgmental, I used to always think that he was being judgmental because I didn't understand how you can declare with strength but not be judgmental. So let me explain the difference. Let's see, how would you say it? You know, things are what they are. Some people are bright, some people are dumb, some actions are fruitful, some actions are foolish, some decisions will bring you the results you want, some won't. You know, there's just realities to this world. If, you know, some person has a big nose, they have a big nose. It just doesn't really help you to pretend that they don't have a big nose if they actually do have a big nose. You know, you have to, if you're a woman, you have a big nose, you have to wear very big earrings so that your nose won't look so small. I learned that from my fashion consultant. People with big noses would always wear little earrings, and she would point out that proportionally your nose got bigger and bigger. She said you need to wear earrings that are bigger than your nose. And you know, you'd see this woman and suddenly she'd wear these big earrings and her whole face would look in proportion. It's really interesting. There's an Italian woman I know, absolutely beautiful, tiny, except she has huge features. Just her features, especially this sort of part of her, is really big. But and I've looked at her. I'm always interested in this sort of thing. I would try to think, how can such a small woman wear such big jewelry and have it not overpower her? Well, it's because she has a very big nose, so she wears all this big jewelry, and then her face looks in proportion. Isn't it? I mean, that's just an interesting fashion fact. But the fact is, that's what she is. And what people sometimes get afraid of is to say, there was a woman once, it was so funny. I mean, Swami can be very frank and private. He's very kind, but he's also, because he's not judgmental. There was this woman who was part of Ananda for a brief period of time. She didn't really have the psychological strength to be part of our path, but someone said, oh, poor so-and-so, I wish she just had more confidence in herself. Swami said, please. He said, the only thing that makes her bearable at all is that she doesn't have the confidence to express herself. He said, if she actually expressed herself, we would not be able to stand her at all. You know, it was, but he gave everything he could to help that woman. There wasn't an ounce of withholding of friendship, energy, support, advice. I mean, really, literally. It was just, but that was a fact. She had a really, really unpleasant personality, and he was just telling you the truth. Her entire approach to life was awful. And that's why she couldn't really stay on our path. But he can and will just say things like that. Because there's no part in him that makes his affection, respect, or loyalty conditioned by the way things are. But to be judgmental is to condition your response according to some likes and dislikes of your own heart. Judgmentalness is when you like and dislike because of how it is. Oh, that person is so uncouth, you know. Just can't bear. Did you see what she was wearing? I can't imagine why she would come out with something like that. I mean, you can just hear it. But to say, oh, did you see what she was wearing? You know, wasn't that just extraordinary? Have you ever seen anything like that? You know, it's just like there she was, dressed like a circus clown, you know, and there she was. And my, I wonder whatever made her think that was attractive. I mean, it just becomes interesting. But there's no part of you that sort of has to have it a certain way, or that is getting one's own security and well-being out of the world being a certain way. You see, overcoming the likes and dislikes of the heart, life can just be what it is. And very often, judgmentalness also, this is the, you know, what we judge in others is what we have to overcome in ourselves is like a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's true. In fact, this woman, Byron Katie, who does some really very interesting and very good work with just helping people get themselves straightened out, she has a technique which is basically anytime you say anything unkind or about someone else, just change the pronoun to I, because it won't even cross your mind unless it's something that's in you. And it's true because, for example, if one is nervous about being stingy, for example, or having bad taste, you know, and not having any sense of beauty, one wants to get rid of that quality in oneself if you consciously or subconsciously know that it's something that you really shouldn't have. So every time it appears in the universe, you have to expunge it. Because whenever it appears in front of you, it reminds you of your own limitations and you become very anxious to get rid of it. You see what I mean? And that's why she said just change it to the I, because different things bother different people. Isn't that true? And the more intensely upset you get about something, very often the more profoundly it means that you have something in yourself to overcome. Now, people carry this to an absurd, even to a stupid point of view, where you're not allowed to make common sense statements about anyone. This is the political correctness to a certain extent, but you just can't say anything. But to discern what is actually happening is the first step often to really solving the problem. If you're not allowed even to discern what's actually happening, because you have to pretend that every option is equal, well, it isn't. Because some things are happiness producing and some things are misery producing. And those are the facts. And you need to be able to use your discernment to be able to tell. Does that make sense? Do you understand that distinction? Because we have to become fearless. We have to become fearless in our ability to perceive. And then you see what you do with it and what that perception does to your own consciousness is whether it's discernment or judgment. And if your happiness depends, if your peace of mind is upset by what you see, and even, it's very interesting, you know, people who are avid for a good cause, you know, we must help these starving refugees, we must expunge this, we must fight against this kind of violence, we must do this, you know, and all this energy is going out to making the universe a certain way. In the evolution of the soul through the caste system, which we've talked about at different times, the Vaishya level, which is called the merchant level, where everything has to be an even exchange. That's why we call it the merchant. One's sense of security and happiness comes from being able to make the world around you conform to what you think it ought to be. My thought of trying to have a closet full of gold so that I could feel safe is a very Vaishya idea. If I can just get the external world in line in a certain way, then I'll feel better. And even though it's many people who are devoted to good causes don't like to hear this, a lot of that social activism is really coming from that level. It's coming from, I will never be comfortable in myself until these environmental conditions are changed. I mean, environmental meaning anything about the world around me. It all has to be different before I will feel okay in myself. Now, that's not the same as compassion, because that's a compulsion from inside yourself. You're not acting from a state of freedom. Now, this is, again, these are the very sensitive issues about how a devotee has to see things in the world. The goal of the spiritual path is not to be nice. The goal of the spiritual path is to be absolutely free, free of all karmic compulsions. And an inability to allow anything, as someone said, to be tolerant of other people's intolerance, is how Ananda Moya Ma said, isn't it to be intolerant of other people's narrow-mindedness also a form of intolerance? I mean, she was joking, half-joking. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't discern. That doesn't mean that you can't even dedicate your life to such a cause. But the kshatriya level of advanced spiritual advancement, because see what happens is, and this is where our discernment comes in, our discrimination comes in. I use the word discernment because it's a little clearer somehow in my mind than the word discrimination. What we learn, and we learn it in the course of one lifetime, and we learn it over many lifetimes, is no matter, two things we learn. No matter how hard we try, the world beyond our own consciousness has a nasty way of not conforming to what we want it to conform to. The woman you love doesn't love you back. You have that closet of gold, and then you get whisked away from the house, and somebody comes in and steals it. You know, you're a beautiful person, and you're young and lovely, and then you grow old. And the child for whom you gave up everything just spurns you and goes off and does something else, you know. Or war comes to your country, or who knows. I had a woman friend, and her family was from Nicaragua. Her father was an extremely wealthy person, and like three different times he lost everything. You know, he lost it to revolution, he lost it to politics, he lost it to earthquake. I mean, just time after time, just his whole life was just blown to pieces. The last time he lost it to revolution and fled the country, and never, I don't know whether he was, whose side of the whole question he was on and whether he was a person I would have even liked, but it was just interesting. He would build and then it would collapse. He would build and then it would collapse. And what happens is the soul remembers these experiences and then begins to learn that maybe this is not really the road to happiness. I mean, all of you, you're sitting in this room because some part of you has already figured out that maybe, you know, Main Street is not really the road that you want to go down. And so you're trying to figure out, or have already figured out, you know, what road you're wanting to go down. You're trying to use your discrimination to figure out what's really going to make you happy. I was in a state of terrible confusion growing up because I had really one skill. I mean, I had a notable academic capacity. And I mean, I seemed like a person who looked like I could do things. But gosh, everything that there was to do, almost 100%, just didn't seem worth doing to me. And it wasn't like it wasn't worthwhile, but I had this karmic memory, which is what I know now it was, of just following all these different paths, you know. So I'll be a professor, so I'll be a doctor, so I'll be a this, or I'll be a that, and just ending up at the end of that road and it not being anywhere I wanted to be. And so I just could never figure out how to get started down that road, because why would I want to go there? Because it wasn't going to take me anywhere that I wanted to be. So I just kind of hung out, not knowing what to do, until Swami Kriyananda crossed my path, until self-realization crossed my path, and then him. But the point here is that at a certain point we realize, one, that the external world is not going to conform, no matter how hard I try. And we retry that over and over again. We just keep reincarnating and trying it from a different tact. This time I'll be a man, this time I'll be a woman, this time I'll be a banker, this time I'll be an engineer, this time I'll live in Guatemala, next time I'll live in India, this time I'll live in America, the next time I'll live in Canada, I'll be an artist, you know, I'll have 10 children, I'll have no children, I'll be a monk, I'll be, you know, just, we just keep trying it, and it just, and finally we realize that the direction of our energy is wrong, that we have to turn the direction in, because all we're ever actually experiencing is our own consciousness. And that at that point you move from Vaishya to Kshatriya, and you realize that my suffering is not caused by the conditions of my life. My suffering is caused by my response to those conditions. And then we become a soldier, a warrior. That's what the Kshatriya level is. But we realize that it's an internal battle. It's an internal battle with all of these vrittis and samskaras and inclinations and likes and dislikes and laziness and desire to hide from the truth. And that's the battle that we begin to fight. And we begin to become very attentive, not so much to what they did to me, but how I respond to what they did to me. And even, you just become very attentive to everything. This is the whole discussion, discrimination. Wow, I really reacted when he spoke like that. And you may not know it till after the fact. This is the battle of Kurukshetra. You get engaged and then you look back and say, wow, what was that all about? I mean, how many of us have had that experience? You know, just many times. Just something happens and you think, wow, I really reacted to that. I was at the YMCA and they started playing music in the indoor swimming pool. My response to it was amazing to me. I mean, I'm talking to the manager, I'm trying to hold back tears. You know, this is like music in the indoor swimming pool. Yes, it's an environment that I enjoyed without the music, and the music in the pool was pretty awful. But I'm just watching myself. You know, I have to ask myself, you really need a vacation. It's like, what does this mean to you that you're so distressed about it? You know, I'm sure we've all had those experiences, you see, and that's the constant discrimination. Why am I reacting like this? And you may say, I often joke, God sometimes makes it exquisite, because often you are right when you got so mad, or you called this person a fool, or you wanted it done this way and they did it the other way. Often you're right. That's what makes it even more fun. You're not wrong, but because of the way you reacted, everything about it is wrong. Because it's not about imposing your will on the external world, it's keeping your consciousness as it's meant to be. And that's the point of discrimination. We learn it in all directions. One of the great things about community is that you get to watch everyone else. You really get to watch. And over many years of living with the same people, you really get to see. And one of the things I've learned is you can't cheat. You know, you think somebody's getting away with something. They have some attitude that they're just not straightening out, and you think they're going to get away with it. One of my friends told me that she had to raise a child, and she wasn't really that interested, really. I mean, she loved her child, but she wasn't that determined. So she didn't put quite as much energy into it. She was just basically trying to outlast the kid. You know, eventually if I just hang out here, the child will grow up, and I'm never really going to have to engage in this. And apparently there's a parallel between early adolescence and toddlerhood. If you don't straighten the things out in toddlerhood, it all hits you at early adolescence. So when this child that had sort of been a little undisciplined as a toddler hit early adolescence, you know, it just all came up again. The woman said to me, sort of jokingly, but like this, I thought I was going to get away with it, you know. But that's a small thing. But you watch, you discern. It's interesting. That person is a little snide all the time. That person is a little disrespectful about certain aspects of the path. That person sort of keeps these worldly interests, and they just never really have been willing to see the consequences of that. Look at it 10, 12, 15 years later. It blew up in their face, didn't it? And you just get to watch, and then you begin to watch yourself in the same way. It's a very constant discrimination. The position that I've been in, I really get to, because people confide in me, and I talk to them, and I know by now hundreds of people really pretty well. It's very interesting. And I'll wonder, I wonder if that's going to work out. Didn't, did it? Or sometimes I think, don't worry, you know, this person is so fundamentally solid and so deeply sincere, and we'll talk about that word in a moment, that it'll work itself out. And I watch, and you know, 10, 12, 15 years later, it works itself out. Because I've seen that the pieces were in place, we don't have to be anxious. Or we see that the wobble in the wheel is going to increase. You know, it's a constant process of what is reality, discerning among the different levels, disciplining ourselves with will and with devotion to behave properly. So, let's take a little bit of a break. And then we will go on from there. Okay? So, do we have any questions or thoughts before I tootle on? Yes.
I was thinking about your examples of someone who's trying to make the exterior world a better place, you know, like social activism and so forth. What if you see suffering, just plain suffering, hunger, disease, where something could be done? Well, so how does that translate to the
kshatriya?
Kshatriya.
You probably have noticed that when people become more spiritually inclined, they don't become less compassionate or less kind or less generous. I mean, truly, true spirituality unites you with all of humanity. But even here, in this lesson, Swamiji talks to us about even in our compassion, we have to use our discernment. And part of our discernment is to think what will really help this situation. See, a lot of times people become so anxious at the sight of other people suffering that they lose their discrimination about what will really help this situation. And they'll pour resources into it, or they'll burn themselves out trying to help, or they'll become angry at everybody on the planet because they're not doing something. And all of these ways do not really solve the problem. So you have to use your discernment even in your compassion. And yes, of course, your discernment says these poor people are suffering. But it's interesting, you see, that oftentimes you go through a social activist period and then you come on the spiritual path and then you feel less inclined to do that kind of work. And so social activists often consider the spiritual path the enemy because it robs them of their workers, because people exhaust themselves trying to make the world into a better place. And it never really gets to be a better place, so they just don't know what to do with themselves. Many people become cynical as a result of that. But the spiritual path rescues you from that, because you recognize, among other things, that people are living the lives that they need to live in order to learn the lessons that they need to learn. And you have to have a lot of faith in God to be able to look comfortably at some of what goes on in this world and not become somewhat hysterical to try to change it. But that's part of what happens as you grow on the spiritual path. But that doesn't mean that you don't help. But you tend to help with more discrimination about what's really going to help. You help with a greater understanding of how I also fit into this picture. When we were in India, on our multiple trips over there, you had to always deal with beggars and deformed people and desperate people and people beating on the windows of your bus and on the walls, the windows of your taxi. And it's endless. It goes on and on and on. And I just developed a kind of comfortableness with the fact that there were all these really poor and miserable people all over the place. And I realized that, even if I gave them some rupees, which is sometimes not such a good idea because then you are, you're practically torn limb from limb. But what they really needed was a change of consciousness, because obviously some flaw in their attunement brought them to that state. Swami Kriyananda remarked after we watched a really good documentary about Mother Teresa of Calcutta many years ago, who picked all the dying people up from the street and so on. He said, I'm now saying it out loud here, but he said it, I really couldn't say this to everyone, he says to the small group of us. He said, but when, the camera came in close and you would see those miserable dying people who were left on the street, he said, you could look into your eyes and you could see how they ended up there. You could just see the wrong consciousness that brought them to that point. You could see that they needed to be there because there were things they didn't know, and that experience was going to help them learn it. Just as Sarah was saying at the beginning, she's having an experience as her body ages with difficult things, but suddenly it's occurred to her how much good is coming out of it for her. And that's what, at a certain point in our lives, we begin to realize, this is fine. It's not fine that they're miserable. It's not like you're happy that they're miserable, but Well, as I was putting it the other day, because I have a lot of willpower and a lot of energy and a lot of can-do spirit, I made a serious error for many years, which is I would essentially try to take over people's lives with my willpower. And I would try to solve their problems for them. And I wasn't so extreme that I burned myself out. I could carry that kind of energy for a pretty long time. But one day I realized that my motivation for doing that was my fear that if I didn't do that, they would never be able to take care of themselves. And I worked it out like this in my mind. You see, this is the process of discrimination. Because I could feel there was something a little off about what I was doing. And I realized that I was not afraid of my own karma. I don't lie awake at night worrying about what God might do to me. I mean, I have natural fears. I wanted a closet full of gold the other night. You know, I'm just like, I'm not, by no means I don't want to exaggerate how fearless I am. But I have a fundamental faith that if God gives it to me, he's going to help me figure out how to work it out. That whatever's going to happen, we'll deal with it. And so I don't lie around worrying. We'll just deal with it, whatever happens. When I slipped and fell in my room and for 10 seconds lying on my back, I'm wondering if I'm, you know, if this is a 911 call or if I'm just going to get up and go on with my day, which was what I did. It's just like, we'll deal with it. We're not going to panic. We'll just deal with it. But I didn't believe that anybody else could deal with their life. I was the only one on the whole planet who could deal with my own karma. Everybody else needed me to deal with their karma. And I realized, my God, is that arrogant? And isn't that really disrespectful? And I realized that other people can't enjoy my company if that's what I really think of them. And I really began to realize, of course they can take care of themselves. I don't mean that they could even solve their own problems, but they can deal with their karma. It's their karma. I realized that when my parents were in their last years also, I was just so nervous. My mother was physically ill and my father was losing his mind. And the whole scene, fortunately they had enough money, we were able to keep them at home and have all this care and so on like that. But the whole scene was not what I would have chosen. And I became really anxious about it. And then one day, again, the same thought came to me. This is their karma, Asha. It feels perfectly natural to them because they got there an inch at a time. I mean, I look at it as if I was suddenly like picked up from where I am and dropped into their karma. And to me, it just did not seem very comfortable. But I looked at them and I really saw they didn't really mind it that much because it was theirs. It was the country they'd spent their whole life hiking into and many incarnations hiking into it. And so I just shifted the whole way that I saw other people's realities. And so even though one still helps, I don't usually feel nervous about what's going to happen. It's like, okay, we'll help if we can, and if I can't help, I won't. Giving money to beggars in India is a really interesting prospect because most of the time you don't feel at all inspired to give. Then every once in a while you'll see somebody, oh yeah, giving money to that person would be a really good idea. Because you just get that it's right. The rest of them, just not for me to do. Does that make sense to you? Yeah, it's a big deal. Don't turn it off, just leave it on.
It seems to me, from observing a lot of people interested in social activism, that they see the impoverished state of a lot of people or the suffering others go through, and they sort of, I think subconsciously, feel like they couldn't handle what the other person goes
exactly
through. And that's what motivates them, is the fear of their situation in their own life.
Right.
And I just wanted to ask if you agree with that. And I guess to expound on what I said, they're motivated out of a sense of fear, not out of a sense of love.
I think
a lot of times.
We don't want to generalize because that would be unkind. But that certainly plays into it. It's that I'll never be comfortable unless the environment is different than it is. Unless the world is different than it is. than it presently is, I will always be uncomfortable. And yeah, and at a certain point, you have to become different than that. You have to understand that God has a role in this. See, a lot of all of that comes out of the all-pervasive atheism of our times, that everything is in human hands and there's no higher purpose to any of this. There's no karma, there's no reincarnation, there's no self-realization. So therefore, it's just like everybody's doing wrong and I need to make them do right. And I certainly need to do right myself, but you see what happens? People get so twisted up because if you use your discernment, the fundamental premise is wrong, which is that this world, this is a teaching hospital. That's what this world is. And we're walking around in it, and we're all the experiences we're having is to teach us about consciousness. And this world is not meant to be a pleasant place. It's meant to disappoint us because this is the battle that I started out talking about. We have to discern among all these warring realities. And one of the realities that wars against our faith in God is, but I want to be happy, but I want to be comfortable, but I don't want to be bothered, and I don't want them to be hungry, and I don't want him to be hurt, and I want that one to happen. And we just think that what we perceive and what we define as good is good. But what God defines as good is when, I started to say this a little while ago, to be absolutely free from compulsion. That's what freedom is. Freedom is to be able to choose. I choose God. I choose with all my heart, mind, and soul. I choose divine love. And fear is not love. Yes, fear may motivate you to do loving things, but sooner or later you have to overcome that fear. And you know, some people are just helping because it gives them great joy to help. It's a whole different, you know, sort of level. And some are helping because they're afraid. And you can, when you're with people, you'll see people who are doing so much good, but you don't like them. You know, because there's something fundamentally odd about their vibration, and that it's often a vibration of either fear or anger. Just one or the other. It's fear or anger that's going on. The first time I went to India and just looked out the window, I mean, the concept of overpopulation, you don't really think about it when you're in America, but when you're in India, you think about overpopulation. You're on the Howrah Bridge for 2.5 hours, and there's an inch between you and all the other vehicles, and your bus is moving forward. I mean, it's like, you say things to yourself like, there are too many people here. There are just way too many people. And there are just way too many people everywhere you go. But there's no solution but a change in consciousness. And that's what you gradually figure out. There's plenty of water, there's plenty of food, there's plenty of money, there's plenty of medical care. The problem is consciousness. And so I often say about myself, I'm very, very socially, politically active. Because I'm teaching people to meditate and believe in God. Because I really think that's the only way to solve the mess. The mess is really self-evident, but, you know, I think I spent a lot of lifetimes cooking up vats of rice and feeding them to hungry people. You know, and if it was ever the right thing to do, I would go back and do it again. But I'm like trying to solve the problem at the level at which I feel it really exists now, which is lack of belief in God, which makes everybody trying to make the world into something it isn't. Greed, everything. It all comes down to consciousness. I often quote Daniel Brinkley, who's dedicated his life to hospice work after having spectacular death and return experiences. And he talks about life greed. And he says the medical healthcare system in the United States is not really a problem, but except because of life greed. He said that, you know, 2/3 of the healthcare dollars spent in the last 6 months of people's lives trying to stave off death. And if we just accepted, oh my goodness, it's time to die, and then we wouldn't be facing this issue. I mean, my uncle, who just passed away last week, 96, on Christmas, they gave him an operation. They operated on this 96-year-old body because he couldn't eat anymore. And instead of just letting him stop eating, which is what he was trying to do, they took him to the hospital and operated on his stomach and extended his life 3 weeks, and then he died. Then he stopped eating and died. You know, even though he, but you see, it's life greed. It's all consciousness. Because we don't believe that anybody's in charge but us. So we have to do it. Now, yes, and then what you have to do with people who feel like that is you have to help them as any way that you can. You have to use your discrimination to think, how can I help this person? And maybe the way you help them is that you never relate to them because you can't stand to relate to them. You don't have the self-control to relate to them. And you realize that I will do more harm than good. Yogananda says, if you are faced with a situation where you know you're going to lose, run away. I love that. Yeah, if you just know you just can't deal with it, you just run away. There's no point in just putting yourself somewhere where you're going to lose your equanimity. But you know, you just try to figure out how to be helpful. When Swami Kriyananda was treated to a speech about when they were trying to stop nuclear war in California, whenever that could have been fully 20 years ago, they had an amendment to do something about nuclear bombs. And very well-meaning people, very good campaign. They did a really good job. They really campaigned to get this anti-nuclear thing. And so part of their presentation was these marvelously effective charts of what would happen when the atom bomb hits whatever city it was. You know, they just had some random city like Chicago. And so then the bomb would hit here, and then they told you how many tens of thousands of people would be vaporized in the first instant. Just vaporized. Nothing would show. Then how many would be incinerated and you would have ash. Then how many would be injured so badly that they would eventually die. I mean, just hold these like concentric circles of horror and destruction, hoping to frighten the life out of you. That was the complete goal. And so they listened. We listened to this whole thing. Swami listened to it. Afterwards, he said to these people, when they finally had a chance, he said, you know, 100 years from now, virtually no one who's on the planet now is still going to be on the planet. He said, and whether we dribble out over the next century or all go to the astral world at the same time, he said, you know, once we're in the astral world, it won't make any difference at all. It was just like, and then what he answered, see, this is again, but then what he answered was, he said, I know that you all mean well and I know your intentions are good, but motivating people through fear is not going to create peace. And that was basically what we were working with. And, you know, then he supported them and he gave them some suggestions about how to do better what they were trying to do, because he knew that for them to be, and see, this is again where you have to use your discernment. You have to look at the person and say, this man is not me. This woman is not me. So from where they're standing, what's their next step? I mean, if you're standing way over here, to go there is backwards. But if this person is standing here, for them it's to go forward. So for somebody to wake up enough and realize, hey, nuclear war is not such a good idea, for them it might be like a gigantic expansion of consciousness. And for someone else to even pay attention to that issue may be a tremendous contraction of consciousness, because they're ready to just trust God and not think about any of those issues. So that's, even within yourself, you have to ask yourself, what's forward for me? That's why I was saying, it's not just about being nice, it's about being free. So sometimes you actually just have to do things that you may not really think are the best things to do, but you have to face your fear. You have to stand up for yourself. You have to assert what you're going to be. You have to declare this or declare that because you're afraid to do it. And until you overcome that fear, you can't just get over it by having it fester in the dark. Among the many attitudes that I've gotten to watch over many years is people coming to Ananda with profound psychological complexes, either from their upbringing or their own behavior, whatever it might be. And then suddenly they come to a spiritual path that says, oh, I can just transcend the ego. So I'm never, ever going to have to deal with any of that. I'm just going to be a devotee and I'm just going to think about God. And meanwhile, all of this unresolved energy is just crazy back here. And they're living in about 8% of their consciousness because all the rest of it is completely owned by these night terrors that they're not working with. But what I've noticed, which is really the good news, is, you know, 10 or 15 years into it, their consciousness will blow up in one way or another. And you can't cheat. If they're sincere, it'll take care of itself. You know, I mean, at first, you know, in the first 2 or 3 years, you would think, oh, this will work. But it doesn't, nothing. You just, sooner or later, you have to face it all. So you might as well just get on with the project. It's a little earlier than later. I remember once I was working for Swamiji as his secretary, and I could be a little, what would be the word? A little heated in my responses to things. I've mellowed over the years. And we were in the market at Ananda Village, and it's a very small place, and I don't remember what the issue was, but I was really having a fairly hot and pretty loud reaction to something. And someone came up to me and said, "You're Swami Kriyananda's secretary. It's really not appropriate for you to behave like that." And I had learned the hard way that what you see is what you get. And I said in a very loud and unpleasant voice, "Well, I am his secretary and I am behaving this way, so there it is." You know, just like, you know, I'm not proud of it, but if that's what's happening, that's what's happening. And you have to just be able to just see it out there. That's discernment. Repression doesn't serve you anything. You have to have the courage to realize. I'm one of my dear friends, lovely woman. She was teaching a class. She's on another spiritual path. And we were in some city somewhere where we happened to have intersected. So we found a little time to spend some time together. And I saw the time coming up to her class. And I said to her, "Don't you have to get ready for your class?" She sort of looked up at me like that. She said, "Too late. What you see is what you get." She said, "I don't think a few minutes is going to make a lot of difference at this point." I mean, she was a meditator, and, you know, she would center her consciousness, but I've always just loved that. "What you see is what you get. There's no point. God knows there, so does everyone else." All right. Is there anything else before we call it an evening?